afternoon. Welcome to We the People. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us, Bill?
Well, we
can
have,
I heckle you today? Let's get that out right away. Are you up for that?
No.
You just did it, though, so
I know it. Yeah, our major sponsor this hour is Pape. Yeah, their major sponsor is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, right between Oasis and Pine Grove exits. Go up and see them if you need anything John Deere. You need a tractor fixed or a mower fixed. They can do it all up there, full parts, sales, and service. Or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at PapeMachinery.com.
So for all you What's Up Doc fans, can you fix a hi-fi?
You can fix a hi-fi, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's a good thing we got cured from the Rona, because we got back just in time for the truck convoy and the war. Good grief, there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
And try to fix Bill's headset. Hold on. Apparently, I can't do more than one thing. I'm like Curly on City Slickers. I'm doing my one thing. Holy cow. So we thought that it would make perfect sense to have Dr. Peter Vincent Pry back on again today, because he knows about all this stuff. And I don't know about you, but I'm a little tired of watching the same 14 seconds of video clip and the same talking heads all say the same thing for an entire week and tell me basically nothing.
Yeah. I watched a video yesterday morning of a truck that got shot up. And just before I went to bed, they were still showing the same video. So
obviously, we're on the radio, so we're not gonna tantalize you with video. But bottom line is, the information just is not all that current, and they're not giving any historical perspective, which would be nice to have every now and then. Just as a point of fact, you can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us, and we have archives going back to 2010, I think, because we're old. So the older we get, the longer we can do this. But the archives are commercial free. They are all long form interviews. At the beginning, we were only an hour, and then at some point, we switched to 2 hours. And I typically like to have the same guest on for the whole time, so we learned something.
Yeah, we just couldn't shut up. We need another hour to get it all out.
Well, the good news is we don't do all the talking. Our phone number and email and all that is on the website if you need to contact us, or if you know somebody who you think we should interview. We do authors, other people who have other talk shows, whoever you think is interesting and you'd like to hear more from them instead of, you know, a minute and a half on some news interview. For those of you who haven't been with us, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He's also the director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both of those are congressional advisory boards. He served as chief of staff of the Congressional EMP Commission, in addition to being on the staffs of the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission and the House Armed Services Committee. He was an intelligence officer with the CIA, responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy. He has a PhD in history and archaeology, and he has another PhD in strategic studies, which is what led him to the CIA. He's the author of numerous books, including Will America Be Protected? That's 2022. Blackout Warfare in 2021, and The Power and the Light in 2020, and he's got a bunch of other ones. And last night, actually more like this morning at 2:30, I updated all the books on the website for you. So you can just click on those and look at the list. It's not an exhaustive list of all his papers by any means, but you can learn quite a bit and get a pretty good perspective on what's going on. I had somebody ask me the other day about EMP, and Dr. Pry is obviously the expert on that. So the date today is February 27th, 2022, just in case we re-air this and the war in Ukraine has done something else, stopped, started.
Escalated.
Yeah, who knows? And I just want you to know that I put his article on here, The Doom of NATO, question mark. So I should have said The Doom of NATO. I'm not an uptalker, so it's kind of hard for me. But you can see he's got a couple of graphics on there if you do go to the website that will be helpful, I think, and instructive as far as the amount of weapons and those kinds of things. So, talking of blue streak there, my blue streak's over. Dr. Pry, it's all you.
Well, I enjoyed your blue streak.
He's all stunned.
I've never been more depressed, more concerned. learned. I don't know if you followed the, first of all, the fog of war, you know, covers this Ukrainian thing, and the press is reporting all kinds of things that we can't tell if they're true or not. The Ukrainian government and the U.S. government have, and the NATO governments all have interests in wanting to construct a narrative that's going to support all of their policy agendas, and as do the Russians. So what is true and what is false, you know, we can't really tell at this point. It is reported, you know, by Russian press, RT and Sputnik, and by the Russian government, that Putin is sitting in his nuclear bunker now and has put his nuclear forces on high alert. Not an exercise. That has rarely happened in history. There are unconfirmed reports that the U.S. nuclear forces have gone to DEFCON 2, which I find very hard to believe. We've never done that in history, not even during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I don't think the United States is capable of going to DEFCON 2 so quickly.
Now, what's DEFCON 2, Dr. Pryor?
Well, there's 5 readiness levels in our system. DEFCON 5 is the normal day-to-day readiness, which means, you know, the ICBMs are ready to launch in a few minutes. And we've got, a couple of ballistic missile submarines out at sea. It takes them longer to launch because they have to get emergency action messages. It can take them hours, but they're basically on patrol out there, and they'll launch as quickly as possible when they get messages. In DEFCON 2, you know, you're increasing the combat readiness. You're starting to mobilize forces, mobilize the bombers, getting the submarines ready to go to sea, all of them. At DEFCON 3, excuse me, yeah, that's right, DEFCON 3, you're at a still higher readiness level where you're just about where the submarines are. You're increasing the number of boats that are out there on patrol, okay? And the bombers are still not ready to go at that point, but they're fueled up. You're loading up cruise missiles on them and the like. DEFCON 2, where we supposedly are, means that all your forces are within 6 hours of readiness to go to war. You know, so I don't see how that could be, because I think if we were submarines to sea and mobilizing the bomber forces, that couldn't be kept secret. You know, that would be known. There'd be so much activity happening. And DEFCON 1, basically, is you're at war. So that would mean that we're supposedly on the threshold. Now, you know, there was an official-looking thing going around the email that had a NATO shield on it that claimed that we were at DEFCON 2. I don't think we've moved off of DEFCON 5, personally. But who knows? You know, I think the Russians probably are at an increased level of readiness. Some of the reporting on that is that they're at the highest level of readiness, and I don't believe that, because that means all of their submarines would be at sea. And although you can do it with the ICBMs, I mean, most of the Russian forces most of their warheads are in ICBMs, which are always ready to go. They can be launched in about 3.5 minutes when they get after getting the authorization code. And, and Putin is supposedly in the deep underground command post. I don't want to dwell on that. And I'm not even raising that as an example of the fog of war thing. It's probably true that the Russian nuclear forces are in an increased state of readiness. They just had an exercise, before this, a supposed exercise, that was probably used to raise the readiness of their nuclear forces clandestinely. And now they're announcing that, yeah, they did raise the readiness of their forces. There was reporting before that. But I don't want to get bogged down in the technical issues. Mm-hmm. Just as long as we're on it, though, to make a liar of myself, to a little more technical issue, we have 5 readiness levels. The Russians have got 4 readiness levels. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a constant combat readiness, which is the level they're on all the time. You know, where the ICBMs are always ready to go. And they've got a couple of submarines at sea that are ready to go. And then there's increased combat readiness, you know, where the ICBMs raise their readiness level. Now, this means that you're putting all the mobile ICBMs out. You know, they're all, usually they have some of them deployed, but not all of them. And they're putting all of that mobile ICBMs out, in addition to the silo-based ICBMs that are ready. And they're starting to get their bombers ready to go, and starting to get submarines ready to go. They can raise the readiness of their submarines faster than we can, because their submarines carry ICBMs, not intermediate-range ballistic missiles. They can hit us launching from their ports. And so this means they've turned on the command control systems necessary to launch those submarines from port if that becomes necessary at increased combat readiness. Then at threat of war readiness, everything is ready, pretty much ready to go and mobilized. Then at full combat readiness, you're at war. And there's a reason why the Russians have four levels of readiness and we have five. Because they know that we have five readiness levels, and they've always tried to achieve a first strike. They always try to mobilize their forces, you know, to get inside of our readiness cycle. But anyway, this whole Ukrainian thing, even the fact that we're just talking about nuclear war now, okay, all right, you know, I've been writing about this. This is one of the things I was very concerned with, that this could escalate out of control. The possibility of something like this happening over Ukraine, in which the United States has no vital strategic interest. I'm just hoping that the worst is not going to happen and that a lot of this is untrue. What I really like to say, if I get across nothing else, I mean, there's so much to say, and we have hours to say it, okay?
Thank goodness.
But one thing I want to hit very hard, very hard. You know, because I'm sure you're not going to hear this from anywhere else. You know, the thing that appalls me most of all about all of this news coverage and everything is, you know, is the press, the Republican Party, everybody who should be looking at this within, all the press narrative appears to be designed to hope or distract people from noticing that President Biden has basically destroyed U.S. superpower credibility and possibly changed the world order so the U.S. is not really, that the world order has changed, that the post-1945 world order that has been based, underwritten by U.S. security guarantees and based on the credibility of the United States, has basically been destroyed by this guy in a day. And why do I say that? Because Biden put America's credibility all on the line. He staked it all on the line, drew a line in the sand over Ukraine, and Russian tanks rolled right over it. And now, his response to this is the incredibly weak response of economic sanctions and fighting to the last brave Ukrainian, you know, by giving them arms while we stand back. Now, if you're a country that's depending upon the United States for your security, and you've seen this happen, it's got to be the final blow, you know, to the credibility of the United States as your global policeman, as the guy that's going to be relied upon to come to your rescue. It's understandable that the press would cover for Biden, or maybe they're just too stupid to actually notice it, and they follow the narrative that comes out of the White House, because the narrative that's coming out of the White House is focused on the brave Ukrainians and, oh, see the trouble the Russians are getting bogged down. and this kind of a narrative, because they're hoping, what the Biden White House is hoping, is that if the Russian invasion of Ukraine doesn't go so well, or even fails, that that'll get Biden off the hook.
Yeah, because he'll be the genius who saved the world.
Yeah, that he'll have backed them off, that will have worked, and his credibility and our credibility remains intact. But it doesn't remain intact. You know, he won't have done anything to make that outcome, except providing, you know, arms to Ukraine. But that's not the thing that will really have.
No. Hold on for two seconds.
I have to. What? Do we have a break coming up?
Yeah, we have a little break here.
This is terrible because I don't want to leave people with the impression that the Russians are bogged down. But I want to get to that when
we let's pick that.
We will pick that up immediately on the backside of this. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing.
You ever love someone? It was so hip to knock the USA. It was so awful and we're so bad. You ought to check the nightlife and live in Grad. It ain't even close. It's better in the USA.
It's better in the USA.
You can see behind the curtain. Life is cold and gray.
It's better in the USA.
How can I make you understand?
Didn't like the end of the song there, Travis? You're on Uber Fade? Very odd. All right, Dr. Pry, can you pick up where
we were talking about the supposed bog down?
Yeah, I didn't want to leave your listeners with the false impression that the Russians are bogged down in Ukraine. That's exactly what the left-wing mainstream media and all of the world in the West, by which I mean the countries allied with the United States, want people to believe. That's part of the narrative. Part of that is to try to rescue Joe Biden, you know, from the humiliation of having destroyed U.S. strategic credibility, you know, put up this tremendous bluff in his eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation with Putin, to Putin, called his bluff and sent the tanks in. And now, you know, there's this desperate game. I think it's a game, or maybe it's just self-delusion, who knows, you know, to try to make it look as bad as possible for the Russians, you know, hoping that that will distract people from what happened. Because it doesn't matter whether the Russians succeed in conquering Ukraine or not. That will be all due to the Ukrainians, not anything the United States has done. Maybe a little bit, because of the arms supplies and the rest. But addressing this issue, are the Russians bogged down? Are they bogging down? It's only been
4 days.
Right. They're already on the outskirts of Kiev. They've only used a third of the forces that they mobilized, you know, to do that. And Ukraine and Putin is doing this because he wants to incorporate Ukraine into Russia again. He considers it part of Russia. So he has all kinds of interests to do this in a surgical way, not as if Ukraine is a NATO member that he just wants to flatten and destroy completely. You know, he wants these people to become loyal to Russia. You know, he needs their population because Russia has got a population problem, as well as just wanting them to become loyal to Russia. And so he has every interest in trying to do this surgically, and that's going to take more time. But given all of that, the fact that they're on the verge of capturing Kiev, you know, in 4 or 5 days, they've been on the outskirts of Kiev for quite a while, and the other major cities as well. You know, they're on their outskirts as well. By way of comparison, you know, when Nazi Germany conquered France in 1940, it did it in 40 days. And that's what was considered a lightning war. It's considered sort of the classic model of an incredibly fast conquest of a country. Ukraine is about the size of France. And, you know, so the Russians are really, assuming the worst reporting or the best reporting from the Ukrainian perspective, the Russians don't look to me like they're doing so bad, despite all this talk about bogging down and everything. Another thing is the Russians have got a vast air superiority that if they went in their whole hog, I mean, we're hearing a lot of reports that the Ukrainian Air Force is doing miracles. I guess there's somebody, they're called the, I can't remember, there's a MiG-25 pilot who supposedly has shot down a lot of advanced Russian jets. Well, that indicates to me that the Russians, perhaps on purpose, you know, didn't make a preemptive strike on the Ukrainian Air Force. And that they're not using their own air force to wreak mass destruction on Ukrainian ground troops and convoys and the like. But we don't know. We don't know what's going on. We don't know the truth of any of that. We don't even really know if the Ukrainian Air Force exists anymore. I mean, we're trusting what the Ukrainian government is telling us, and the Ukrainian government has every interest in convincing the West that they're putting up this heroic stand to try to encourage the NATO countries to jump in, to provide them with more arms, maybe directly intervene, maybe establish a no-fly zone over Ukraine to draw us in as much as we can. And astonishingly, almost all the Republicans are on board with this and supporting Joe Biden, this is a chance to unify the country behind a policy that goes against the national security interests of the United States, because, you know, it is not in the interests of the American people to get in a nuclear war with Russia for Ukrainian sovereignty. It's not in our interests to spend one American life for Ukrainian sovereignty. They're not in NATO, but we're confirming the worst accusations that Moscow was making about the Partnership for Peace, which was supposed to be an interim step to NATO. You know, Putin was accusing us of saying, look, just because Ukraine is not officially in NATO, nonetheless, we suspect you guys are going to treat them like they're a de facto member of NATO. And that is exactly what we're doing, or it seems to be that that's what we're doing. We haven't gone to nuclear war for Ukraine yet, but we're doing everything except that, almost everything except that. Fortunately, Biden hasn't sent any U.S. troops into Ukraine yet. We are sending arms into Ukraine in every way we can, as if, you know, why? You know, as if they're a NATO member state. And it's just very discouraging that the loyal opposition is not taking the position that Tucker Carlson takes every night, you know, which is the position that's fundamentally, I don't agree with Tucker that Russia is not a threat to the United States. I think he goes too far. Russia is a mortal threat to us. They could destroy our country in 30 minutes. But that makes it all the more compelling an argument,
yeah,
as to why the United States should not be involving itself in the situation with Ukraine. I think from previous shows, I've talked to so many different shows and done so many interviews now, I can't remember if on your show I made my case the way this issue should have been resolved, was that the Washington should have provided assurances to Russia that Ukraine was not going to become a member of NATO, and we weren't going to expand NATO any further eastward. And before all of this began, Russia offered what they call a peace treaty that had six demands. And I could go over all six of those demands and make a case as to how we could negotiate those points you know, not just caved everything Russia wanted, but we could negotiate those points and reach a compromise on all six of those points. And it would have been the beginning of hitting the reset button with Russia so that we could turn them into a strategic partner, or at least a neutral in the new Cold War with China. You know, because the most fundamental interest the United States has is not Ukrainian sovereignty, but it's the fact that we face this unprecedented military economic block, power block, in the Russia-China alliance. It's the most formidable, dangerous block we've ever faced, that the free world has ever faced in its history. And this block includes North Korea and Iran as well. Even one of the smallest members of this bloc, North Korea, is more dangerous to us than Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan were combined, because those countries did not have ICBMs armed with hydrogen bombs that could reach every American city. And that's what North Korea just by itself can do, but it's part of this power bloc. So what's the United States to do at the biggest foreign and defense policy objective we should have had and should still have is splitting that block, splitting that power block. The fact that they're allied together makes both of them more aggressive. And at this moment, when the West is economically and militarily weak, you know, it encourages them to engage in military aggression. But if we could persuade Russia to become a strategic partner, which is what Ronald Reagan wanted to do, and what George H. Bush wanted to do when the Cold War ended, and we were victorious in the Cold War, and we had wiser heads in Washington, that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to make sure that Russia would not come back as a revanchist nuclear superpower, you know, seeking to reestablish the USSR and take vengeance against the West, which is where we are today. That got lost sight of under the Clinton administration, and then by George W. Bush it got lost sight of when he decided to expand NATO to the East, which guaranteed that we were going to bring about the very circumstance that we face today, where the sides may be on the threshold of a global nuclear war over Ukraine. That's not in our interests to be there, to be putting the existence of our nation at risk for that. The smart chess move on the geopolitical chessboard would have been to get Russia on our side. And I think Russia wanted to come onto our side. Putin was waiting for Trump to hit the reset button because Trump and General Flynn planned to do that. You know, they understood that China was the bigger threat. And I think Putin understands that in the long run, China is a bigger threat to Russia than the United States for the West. And Putin was waiting for that move, that offer from Trump, but it never came. Trump was never politically in a position to do that, you know, because of these false charges that he was Putin's puppet and that the Russians got him elected, so he wasn't legitimately the president of the United States, and all of that nonsense that we went through for 4 years, all of it being proven false. And so that might have proven to be a fatal, mortal mistake in the West, that opportunity was lost. But the opportunity represented itself again. In a sense, the Ukrainian crisis could have been a golden opportunity when Moscow offered that peace treaty. It was an opportunity to sit down and negotiate our differences and change the fundamental relationship between the United States and Russia from one of confrontation to one of strategic partnership, or at least moving Russia into neutrality. And now that the Biden administration decided to follow the path of confrontation drew the line in the sand, and Putin crossed it, you know, it's obviously impossible at this point for us to hit a reset button and have a negotiation with Russia about becoming a strategic partner, because that would be clearly a sign of weakness, that in response to their conquest or attempted conquest of Ukraine, now we offer the olive branch.
Yeah, you can't
do
that.
That would just inspire aggression on the part of the Russians. They would have contempt for weakness. So, you know, we have to rebuild American credibility in the aftermath of all this, by rebuilding, making our electric grid and other critical infrastructures, hardening them against cyber and EMP attack. You know, we need to, I think we should deploy space-based missile defenses the way Ronald Reagan had wanted to try to render Russian and Chinese and North Korean and Iranian missiles obsolete, especially nuclear missiles. That would be something that would really hurt all of our adversaries and be far more impressive than the feather of economic sanctions. And we need to catch up with the Russians in the modernization of our nuclear forces, and especially tactical nuclear weapons, which they have at least a 10-to-1 advantage over us, NATO. You know, we've only got 180 tactical nuclear weapons. They've got 2,000 to 8,000, and ours are obsolete old gravity bombs.
Yeah, can you explain to our listeners the difference between the tactical nuclear weapons and strategic?
Sure. In theory, in military theory, the difference is that strategic weapons are weapons that are designed to reach the homeland of your adversary. So Russian strategic weapons are intercontinental weapons that can be delivered by ICBMs or sub-launch ballistic missiles or long-range strategic bombers. They typically have high yields so that they can destroy hardened missile silos, hardened command posts, and submarine pens, and blast, bomber bases. Tactical nuclear weapons are meant for battlefield use, typically in European NATO. And they can have a whole wide range of yields, typically much lower yields than strategic nuclear weapons, so that they can be used for practical battlefield applications, blasting bridges, blasting command posts, taking out an armored division or an armored battalion, blasting an aircraft carrier with a nuclear-armed torpedo, for example. A lot of people criticize the distinction between tactical and strategic because they point out that Russian tactical nuclear weapons are strategic weapons to everybody who neighbors Russia, because their homelands can be reached in Europe, in Asia, by these tactical nuclear weapons. But anyway, that's the difference. They have shorter ranges, they have lower yields, and there's a big technological difference between American and Russian tactical nuclear weapons because they're 30 years ahead of us, because of Russian cheating on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. They've got new generation tactical nuclear weapons that are ultra-low yield, that produce no radioactive fallout, that are small enough to be used as like air-to-air missiles. They use them out of artillery. They could use them from tanks for land forces, air forces, sea forces. They have specialized effects like EMP or X-rays or neutron radiation. We don't have any of that. Our tactical nuclear weapons tend to have higher yields and will produce radioactive fallout, and are not, there are many, many fewer of them, and they're not designed for making our land, sea, and air forces, basically nuclear armed, whereas the Russians are. It's like they've adopted, under President Eisenhower, he wanted to have a revolution, to revolutionize the warfighting capabilities of all U.S. services by having them incorporate nuclear arms of all kinds into all of the services. And we did that for a while under Eisenhower in the new look. And it's like the Russians, I mean, I'm not going to say they copied that, but that's a way of understanding it. They've always thought that way, and they've been following the new look forever. Well, Eisenhower called the new look, and have just gotten better and better at it, and developed better and better technologies.
Meanwhile, we've been worrying about windmills, et cetera.
Right, climate change.
Climate change, the existential threat. We have to take another really quick break, but I was going to add the quote from the top of your article from President Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt. The unforgivable crime is soft hitting. Do not hit at all if it can be avoided, but never hit softly. Never. And it's like, huh, we ought to make bumper stickers and just, you know, drive around Washington, D.C. with those on all the time.
It seems to be what our...
I would go for tattoos, but that just takes too much time. All right.
When we come back, let's talk about economic sanctions and how that's relevant.
That's the one that concerns me.
Great that's been. So our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Let me know you're here, 'cause my TV set just keeps it all from being clear. I want a reason for the way things have to be. I need a hand to help build up some kind of hope inside of me. And I
It's like every day, except for the...
What the heck
get
is
real
going
high
on?
Yeah, the stick your head out the door and just scream. That's about all we have left to us. Dr. Pry, before we move on to the sanctions part, I was looking at the graphic that you had given us, and I thought that the... You know, when you look at the tactical nuclear weapons, 180 on our side, in the NATO side, and Russia, 2,000 to 8,000. What could go wrong?
Right.
And Bill was reminding me that
category, we have no chemical weapons.
Yeah, I saw that too. No chemical, no biological.
No biological weapons. They have biological weapons. Maybe we have cyber weapons. We've never demonstrated that we have highly effective cyber weapons. The Russians definitely have cyber weapons. We know that. And of course, there's enormous disparities in the other categories of military power as well. 20,000 tanks on the Russian side versus about 1,100 for NATO, all of the NATO along the invasion route. I'm talking about Poland, Germany, France, Denmark, and the Benelux countries.
Yeah, that's Britain. A pretty thin line.
Yeah, they're outnumbered basically 20 to 1 in armor and about 2 to 1 in manpower. It could be much more than that because the Russians have more than a million men in the army. They can draw upon much larger reserves to mobilize, you know, if they wanted to take the time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But they're outnumbered in every category. NATO is outnumbered in every category. It's basically been hollowed out militarily by these socialist democrat governments, just like the Biden administration, that want to put all their focus on climate change and social welfare and despise the military. And they're globalists. This is getting maybe to the later part of our conversation, but, you know, they that look to They despise nationalism and patriotism in the military, and they look to supranational institutions like the United Nations, international law, and the U.S. global policemen to protect them.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, they've been hollowed out militarily over the years. I mean, in 1989, we had 5,000 tanks in Germany to protect NATO. The Obama administration took all of those out and went down to zero main battle tanks in NATO. And Trump started trying to put them back and reverse that. But today we only have 100 main battle tanks from the United States to join the small numbers of main battle tanks that exist in the other NATO-aligned countries. So Russia could... That's why we should not want this war to last long. Even if we're sympathetic to the Ukrainians and all the rest, you know, we don't want Russia to be provoked into invading NATO or basically invited in because of the weakness of the West, you know.
That brings up...
Hands-off policy would be much safer because they can go to the English Channel if they want to.
Sure, sure. And that brings up these economic sanctions we're, you know, holding so highly, which is so dangerous. Let's talk about that.
I couldn't believe a reporter asked the president, I mean, even the press, even the liberal mainstream press in the White House press office that always pitches him softballs, could hardly believe it, because one reporter asked them, you know, did a double take, and they said, you know, Mr. President, so you're going to impose economic sanctions in response to tanks and missiles and aircraft, you know, attacking Ukraine. Do you really consider that a proportionate and equivalent response? And Biden said yes.
Yes.
And they let him go, but they asked the question twice because I think they could hardly believe their ears. And that, my friends, is the moment, I think. You could actually go to that moment, future historians, about when did the United States cease to be a credible superpower. And you could probably go to that moment when the President of the United States compared economic sanctions as equivalent, you know, to the actual killing of people and the invasion of a country by tanks and aircraft and missiles. All of our allies listening to that, you know, what could they conclude from that? Is that what the United States is going to do to protect Japan and South Korea and the Philippines and the NATO alliance itself, that we'll sit back and levy economic sanctions to punish Putin or China for military aggression, and we will consider that an equivalent response, and our superpower responsibilities will have been fulfilled by such an act. You know, as I state in the article, I mean, I think all thinking people, at least I hoped until I've been following the press coverage recently, because one of the most appalling things to me is a lot of the reporters have kind of gone along with that now, and the debate is not whether economic sanctions are a serious response, you know, but what kind of economic sanctions, you know, is it increasing the economic sanctions to taking Russia out of SWIFT? Oh, that's going to really hurt them. That'll make a difference.
They'll pull out of Ukraine now. Yeah.
And I'm not arguing. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's what I'm saying is I look at that as just poking the bear one more time and just asking for a legitimate military response, and we're not prepared for that. And they
keep
piling this stuff on like it's going to back them down. You had on what we posted on the website here that economic sanctions are ineffectual and dangerous, and you went through some of the reasons on that, which I thought was really interesting. How in the past, economic sanctions never worked. And here we go again.
Yeah, not only have they never worked, but when our adversaries have found that that's all we're going to do, they become even more aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, economic sanctions didn't work against Russia when they annexed Crimea. And here they are now, back for more, invading Ukraine. You know, economic sanctions haven't worked against China, making cyber attacks against the United States, stealing our technology, making threats against Taiwan. By the way, now China is going to be having a big naval exercise in the South China Sea beginning this week.
Hmm.
So maybe that's the beginning of another front.
Exactly.
Economic sanctions did not stop North Korea from developing ICBMs, atomic bombs, hydrogen bombs, and missiles that can reach any city in the United States. You know, economic sanctions haven't stopped Iran from pursuing the atomic bomb. So now, even the optimists think that they're only 8 weeks away from being able to have an atomic bomb. I think they've had one for years now. So economic sanctions have got a history of failure. Economic sanctions in World War II against Japan were treated with such contempt that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, you know, as a consequence of that. So they're not only are they ineffective, but they're actually dangerous, provocative, because when you're dealing with military dictatorships that only respect military strength, to them, when economic sanctions look like a sign of cowardice, and cultural degeneracy and bankruptcy, and are tantamount to a surrender, tantamount to admission that we're not willing to fight and we're willing to surrender. Now, having said that, I'm not criticizing Biden for not fighting. I think he was. I don't want to fight for Ukraine. I don't think we should have gotten involved in the Ukrainian thing. But he did when he's and that's the ultimate idiocy about all of this thing, that he acts as if Ukraine is a vital strategic U.S. national interest, described it as such to the world, drew a line in the sand, and then when Russians called him on it, all he's going to do is respond with economic sanctions and this airlifting of weapons to the Ukrainians so that we're willing to fight to the last dead Ukrainian, okay?
Yeah.
But
I guess that's why they put the line in the sand. They just hope for a high tide.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just you look at all this and it doesn't go anywhere good. Your article does an excellent job of laying that out. And tell me this, besides the fact that it's on our site, is it called The Doom of NATO? Is that how the article was published?
The Doom of NATO, ? Newsmax has published it in pieces.
Okay.
And it isn't called, and that's behind a paywall, a platinum paywall.
Oh, look what you get here. You get
Newsmax
the free article.
Platinum, which is one of the reasons I sent the whole thing to you.
Okay, I appreciate that. We're going to be back for the second hour with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. In the meantime, you can go to our website and read that article. It is
wethepeopleradio.us.
Mr.